Hello, what is up, and welcome to Off the Books, where we're surfing the uncharted waters of accounting, of finance, and wherever else those waves take us. Off the Books is brought to you by Workiva, the number one platform for SOX compliance, SEC reporting, internal audit management, and way mucho much more. Basically, if it's got numbers and narrative, and your kids have no idea what you do for a living, Workiva is the platform for you. I'm Drew Dubner, and I am your host. I'm not an accountant, but I like asking questions of people who are, so finance professionals can do their jobs better. Today, oh, we've got a doozy of a show. We've got Jen Neal. We've got Emily McLaughlin. And the omnipresent, often imitated, but never duplicated, Steve Soder. Steve, would you tell the fine folks at home who you are?
Yes, certainly, and happy to join today. My name is Steve Soder, accounting enthusiast and Diet Coke aficionado. I am very much looking forward to debiting a bit of a shift in perspective today as we talk about private equity.
Emily?
I'm Emily McLaughlin, and I've been doing accounting for 20 years, accounting and financial reporting, and just pleased to be here, so thank you.
Excellent. And last but not least, Jen.
Sure. Thanks for having us today. I'm Jennifer Neal. I think the best way to describe me is probably a recovering investment banker, although I don't ever seem to really recover from it. I just keep going back down that rabbit hole, and also was a college soccer player. So that might explain a little bit of my type A personality, if you will.
Excellent. Excellent. And what a type A type of a show we've got. So today we're covering the wild, wacky world of private equity firms. For the uninitiated out there, myself included, a private equity firm is basically in the business of buying businesses. They buy public companies, they take control, then delist the company, or often they buy a private company who has no public stock, let it grow in value, and sell it at a profit. They can buy and sell quickly for a fast gain, or sometimes pick up a failing company and make a return by dismantling it. But this is not an overnight process. Private equity can't be done in a week or two. They buy and hold and rebuild over a long period of time. So, Jen, Emily, did I describe private equity companies correctly? Was that a good summarization?
I think so. I think there's also another option that could belong into that list of what private equity does. At times, they will buy they'll have a private company that will buy a public company, and instead of delisting it, they'll essentially take over the listing and continue with that company as a public company. So there are some permutations out there. Jen?
Yes, I think the last thing I would say is occasionally, it doesn't happen as often as it used to, but private equity looks for an exit being either another private equity firm, a strategic buyer, or a public exit. And I think the public exit was the only thing that maybe we didn't mention. Although the public exits certainly of interest here, but probably aren't as prevalent as they once were.
And certainly not in this economy.
Makes sense.
So you used a term that I'm not sure all of our listeners would be familiar with, which is a strategic buyer, a strategic acquisition. Is that a little bit different? Tell us what's involved in that.
Sure. So a lot of times when we refer to buyers of a company, we'll talk about either a strategic buyer, a like-minded company that's in their same industry, or a financial buyer, which would be another private equity firm. So for instance, at one point, Leonard Green, a very large retail and consumer-focused private equity firm out of Los Angeles, owned Gart Brothers Sporting Goods that was in Colorado for a number of years. It eventually merged with the Sports Authority, which is why you didn't hear about Gart, after, call it the mid-2000s. But before that, when Leonard Green exited Gart, they could have sold Gart to Dick's Sporting Goods, which would have been a sale to a strategic buyer. They could have taken it public, which is what they did, or they could have sold it to what we would call a financial buyer, another private equity firm, Texas Pacific, somebody bigger than Leonard Green.
So the type of buyer depends on their intention of what they want to do with the company?
It does, and it also depends on the valuation that they're seeing in the market when they go to exit. Historically, the best exits have been to the public markets, but that's not necessarily the case these days. Back in the 80s and early 90s, yes, absolutely. You know, the public markets gave you the best valuation, and it was certainly the cleanest way to get out because you could sell a large chunk, and there wasn't as much of an overhang that you had in the stock at that point. A piece of jargon that you'll hear is private equity overhang, and that's the amount of money that's sitting in private equity firms. As time passed, more PE firms look to exit through private transactions with strategic buyers or with other private equity firms. Historically, a strategic buyer has been able to pay more than another private equity buyer, and that's because they are in the business and they necessarily have built-in synergies when they buy a similar business. They wouldn't have to duplicate, or they could get rid of duplicative overhead. They could get rid of duplicative processes.
Jen, you actually brought up a word, synergies, that I've heard many times over a period in my life was when I was at a company named BlueLinx, which is publicly traded. So I'm not going to say anything that's material, non-public information, because it's all public. And BlueLinx bought Cedar Creek from a private equity group called Charles Bank. And the market initially loved that story because of the $50 million in synergies that were supposed to be created. So everything I heard was synergy, synergy, synergy. And ultimately, some of those synergies failed to materialize. And the market was, I think, at that point, not in love with the story as much. The share price, fairly close to immediately after the acquisition, went up to around $40 a share. And then most recently, BlueLinx got another delisting notice because they had fallen below their market cap requirements. The New York Stock Exchange will not let you be listed if you have less than $50 million in market cap and $50 million in equity. So there are some pretty stringent requirements, but I think the share price at that point was somewhere around $2.80, $3. I think they've gone up since then, but it's quite the fall from grace from $40 to $3.
I imagine.
It's interesting. So I guess you're telling me that Drew and I can't go start Drew and Steve Podcast LLC, raise a bunch of money and try to go invest in other companies, at least not if we can't hit $50 million. Is that what I gather?
You could, but you could not, buy up the stock of you wouldn't have the capital, unfortunately, to buy up the stock of a public company. Unless it's me, Hertz. I don't know what they're doing right now.
That's interesting. So we've talked a lot about exits and that kind of thing, and I gather that that's where private equity companies generate their returns. I'm just wondering, I bet with our listeners, there's some misunderstanding about how these companies actually generate a return for their shareholders, which obviously, as we've discussed, happens when they actually sell the firm. But I'm just wondering, what do those exits look like? What do the transactions look like? And I imagine all of that's potentially been upended through COVID-19?
Sure. The structure is a general partner with limited partners behind it. The limited partners put money into the general partnership, and the general partnership is the named entity that goes out and acquires businesses. The way private equity groups generate returns for the limited partners, number one, what they're trying to do is maximize the equity returns to the limited partners. So there's a few levers they can pull to do that. At the outset, they can finance the business with equity or debt. All things being equal, they're going to want to use more debt than equity because, again, it increases the equity return. So assuming it's a healthy business, you'll see them put debt on the business to finance the business. And assuming that the business, again, can sustain that level of debt, then what you'll see is over time, as the business grows and the EBITDA grows, they can borrow more money because they can service more debt. And so they'll continue to refinance the business and put more debt on the business. At the same time, they will take dividends in the form of cash out of the business, which again pushes the debt level higher and the equity level lower. And so a lot of times what you'll see is by the time a private equity firm exits a business, they will have taken sufficient dividends to have returned their entire equity investment and more.
I was involved in auditing back when I was an auditor. A company that a private equity firm had bought, and since I was in a private company services audit, that was pretty much what I did at PwC, was audit private companies. And so this big PE firm had just acquired a bus manufacturer for 20 cents on the dollar from a Hungarian bank. The reason why it was 20 cents on the dollar that they bought that debt, and essentially then they bought the company for, was because the Hungarian bank wanted some sort of return, anything. So then this private equity firm bought up three other bus companies and decided to essentially consolidate the bus industry. So transit buses, school buses, and trolleys. So this PE group bought all those companies and basically stitched them together. And well after I left the audit firm, the bus company went public. They took the company public, and it was basically a success. I mean, it was pretty much a success story when they bought just the one company for 20 cents on the dollar, that very low investment, and then stitching it with all these other companies and taking it public got them, you know, basically the return that they were looking for.
So you can take other smaller companies and like congeal it into a Voltron of companies?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
That's cool.
Yes, you can stitch companies together. You can take them apart.
And that is a good spot for a quick break. Hang tight for a second. We got one commercial for you. Back in a moment. Today's episode of Off the Books is brought to you by Workiva. I found a website yesterday called lookslikeyouneediceland.com, created by the Tourism Bureau of Iceland, the country. In an effort to help people, wherever they are, release some stress, you can record yourself screaming, upload it to the site, and they will blast that scream over loudspeakers in the Icelandic wilderness. Yes, dear listener, if you listen really, really hard and visit the outskirts of Reykjavik at 3 a.m., you can hear Steve scream bloody murder about 7-Eleven running out of Diet Coke Slurpee. If your scream, as you think of it, would mention something about terrible compliance and risk and reporting processes, let me introduce you to Workiva. Yes, Workiva. Automate all that awful, useless copy and pasting and spend more time actually doing your job. Fancy that. Communicate with your colleagues right inside the platform without sending emails or text messages or screaming into the Nordic wild. Workiva, it is the risk and reporting catharsis you've been longing for without hurting your precious vocal cords. Check out workiva.com/podcast to learn more and to get a demo. That's workiva.com/podcast. And welcome back. Jen, Emily, I have a question for you. Given the state of everything, as I gesture broadly at the weird world around us, how has private equity changed? Like all the volatility and uncertainty with COVID-19, it must have been a really wild ride for the industry on the whole.
Just knowing what I know on a general basis, it's probably a great time with, say, the capital that's sloshing around out there in private equity to pick up some distressed assets, some distressed companies, that sort of thing, and really, you know, do what they do best. On the other hand, no one wants to catch the falling knife. So when you make that acquisition becomes important, so as not to distort your returns.
True. Steve was talking about buying a bus company recently, so.
Absolutely. I feel like now is the best time to be in busing. You know, lots of people crammed together in a bus. What could go wrong?
Absolutely nothing, as long as you wear your mask, right?
Exactly.
And your hazmat suit.
Correct.
So maybe my next question is best suited for you, Jen. What was surprising about this? Was there anything that surprised you in this, in the whole COVID-19 situation?
You know, Sun Capital has, they like deals that have some sort of issue. They look for troubled companies, or they look for companies that may have fallen on hard times. Sun has been extraordinarily active during COVID-19. And one of the things they do extremely well are corporate carve-outs. They're looking at businesses that probably have underperforming units or operations and carving those out. And they've been extraordinarily successful during COVID-19. And I don't know that I would say I was surprised, but I'm surprised by the amount of activity.
And this has got to also be a very difficult time for other private equity companies that potentially are in, say, the retail space, or have heavy investments in entertainment events, for example, because it is currently impossible to have a very large gathering of people, say, in a tent, and have them watch a performance, a live performance. That's just not going to happen, masks or no, for a long time.
So that would be an example where, you know, you had picked up this company and things were going well, dividends, management fees, recapitalization, all that stuff. And then COVID happens. And then, you know, your investment is maybe not worthless, but certainly much less than it used to be. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, is that, I'm assuming, Emily, that's what you're alluding to?
That's a fair statement. Yes. I mean, I think it's very public knowledge that Cirque du Soleil, which is private equity owned, has filed for bankruptcy. So that's, you know, say one of those things. If that particular PE firm is heavily invested in that type of space, it could very well be an issue for them.
And I'm assuming then, Jen, back to your point about the those who look for distressed assets, that in turn may be an opportunity for them. Hey, here's this suddenly distressed asset. Yeah, we've got an idea. We could see how this could grow in value. Hey, yeah, we're going to go pick that up on the cheap as a result of everything that's happening. I mean, is that how this all kind of comes together?
Yeah, it does. The structure of private equity is to use debt financing to leverage the business. You're using leveraged finance to generate that equity return for your LPs. And as a result, not only are they not able to make just their interest payments, but they can't even make their principal payments. When a business just fundamentally stops, like Cirque du Soleil, you're not going to be able to make any of those payments, and your capital structure is, it's a non-starter for you.
So it sounds like people should be thinking about private equity not as much as, hey, we've got this huge pot of money to invest, which is true, as we've talked about, but also a company that says, hey, I've got an ability to go generate some debt. I'm really good at arranging financing for these companies. I can then use that as an additional vehicle for a way that I would make these investments. I mean, I'm assuming that's an accurate statement as well, based on what you just said.
So if somebody's got a really good relationship with capital providers and has good experience dealing with distressed businesses and how to turn those around, yes, absolutely. There's absolutely an opportunity right now.
Emily, there's been a lot of scrutiny over the years, including by, you know, even presidential candidates, about the ills of private equity. Could you maybe respond to those criticisms, not directly to presidential candidates, but
Romney 2012.
Well, I just wonder, could you provide your perspective on what's really going on? I work for private equity. There were some downsides to it, but there were some positives as well in terms of what it did for my career. That's from an employee perspective. Obviously, there are other stakeholders, but could you share a little bit about your perspective?
Of course. I mean, I think that private equity generally fills a very valuable niche, right? It fulfills the niche in between, say, the mom and pop. The founder has capital from friends and family and maybe some bank stuff thrown in. Between that and the huge publicly traded companies, it fits that niche. It fits that niche really well. And where it can really fit that niche is where there are market efficiencies to be gained by, for example, taking over a bus company that's failing, conglomerating it with some other bus companies, taking it public and making it successful. So there are private equity companies, private equity groups filling a lot of gaps and also taking risks that public companies might not take and mom and pop companies can't take because they're too small. So I think that there's definitely a niche that they fulfill even though there has been some criticism of, say, excessive profit taking, you know, you think about Mitt Romney, Bain Capital, and that very famous picture of him with all the dollar bills around him, cigar in his mouth, all that good stuff. So that's where, you know, you get a look that's not too good, so to speak. But on the other hand, I'm sure that they were just having fun and blowing off steam.
There's been so much pressure recently, I sense, from large private equity and other investing firms about environmental, social, and governance initiatives, ESG. You know, BlackRock issued their sustainability letter that caused a lot of waves. Could you just give us a sense for how that's impacting the private equity market overall and how big a deal that really was?
I think with BlackRock doing that, I think it put everybody on notice that yes, these are issues in the private equity world. I think the private equity world is, not surprisingly, overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly male, and has a very big problem when it comes to diversity. And so, yes, BlackRock's letter, the ESG initiatives, I think go a long way towards helping to level that playing field a little bit. And I think a lot of private equity firms at least take a notice of it. I think they're starting to think about diversity, to think about being better stewards of the money that they've got. I think they're starting to be better stewards and paying more attention to it's not all about the profit. Sometimes it's about the people. It's about the culture. It's about the environment. So you're seeing private equity, I think, especially starting to look very favorably on businesses that have a cause associated with them. And businesses with causes are certainly getting premium multiples in the market these days.
And really, sure, everybody needs to pay attention to ESG, right? I mean, you've got so many, like for public companies, so many shareholders bringing up proposals to do more about the environment and the environmental impact of their products. I'm thinking like, say, Starbucks here, right? Pledging to have zero waste by a certain date, or, you know, everything recyclable by a certain date. All of that sort of thing, it filters down through every company. So every company should be thinking about ESG. And I think it's especially important for private equity to make themselves more attractive, right?
And that talk about coffee really pairs pretty well with our closing question of the day. Every episode we close on a lighthearted note, a little fun question. And today's question is, what's your favorite breakfast cereal? And what does that say about you, Steve?
Well, I'm glad you asked. There is actually a Big Bird mosaic that is made of some, it looks like Applejack, some honeycomb. For the contrast, I think there's some blueberry marshmallows. I am a fan of all of those things, as I am a fan of Big Bird. And what I think that says about me is that I have excellent taste in breakfast cereal.
I would agree. Emily.
I do not eat breakfast cereal, but I do drink coffee. Mm. So what I would say that says about me is that I am definitely an accountant.
My favorite breakfast cereal, I think my favorite breakfast cereal in the world would have to be Cookie Crisp. And I guess it's that even, you know, somebody who was a college athlete and tries to be fit lives by a motto that my grandmother used to use on us all the time, which was everything in moderation, including moderation. So I think that may explain at least the taste for Cookie Crisp.
Everything in moderation, including this conversation. So that wraps things up for us today. I'm Drew Dubner. This has been Off the Books. Please subscribe, leave a review, mail me a case of Grape Nuts, my favorite cereal, or tell your buddies if you like the show. Surf's up, and we'll see you on the next wave.